broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
No one has ever doubted that truth and politics are on rather bad terms with each other. And no one, as far as I know, has ever counted truthfulness among the political virtues. Lies have always been regarded as necessary and justifiable tools, not only of the politicians or the demagogues, but also of the statesman's trade. Why is that so? And what does it mean for the nature and the dignity of the political realm on one side, and for the nature and the dignity of truth and truthfulness on the other? Is it of the very essence of truth to be impotent, and of the very essence of power to be deceitful? And what kind of reality does truth possess if it is powerless in the public realm, which more than any other sphere of human life guarantees reality of existence to natal and mortal man, that is, to beings who know they have appeared out of non-being and will, after a short while, again disappear into it? Finally, is not impotent truth just as despicable as power that gives no heed to truth? These are uncomfortable questions, but they arise necessarily out of our current convictions in this matter. Hannah Arendt, in her article in The New Yorker, February 25, 1967, in The New Yorker. Welcome to Delmarva Today Writers Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. This is the third in our three-part series on truth. In the first, we discuss the nature of truth and what it might mean to live in a post-truth era. The second program focused on civil society and how cultures develop when truth is denigrated. Today, we focus on truth and its relation to politics. As with the other two discussions on truth, I'm joined by Don Rush and Adam Wood. Don Rush is Associate Program Director, Senior Producer, News and Public Affairs at Delmarva Public Radio. And Adam Wood is Chairman of the Department of English at Salisbury University and Chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure. In addition, we're joined today by Michael O'Loughlin, a professor in the Political Science Department at the university. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you for having us.
Good to be here.
In her brilliant article, Truth and Politics, Arendt suggests that truth is neither given to nor disclosed to man, but is produced by the human mind. This seems to me to be an important distinction. She goes on to say that the modern age has designed mathematical, scientific, and philosophical truths, such as discoveries, theories, and axioms, for example, to the common class of what she calls rational truth. This Arendt distinguishes from factual truth, the invariable outcomes of people living and acting together. And because facts and events are the invariable outcome of people living and acting together, and constitute the texture of our political realm, she says that it is factual truth we need to be concerned with in looking at truth and politics. Also, because she wants to look in her article at what injury political power can inflict on truth, she is looking at the issue of truth from a political and not a philosophical perspective. For this reason, Arndt says that she is not concerned with what truth is, but chooses to use the word as it is commonly understood. This is a primary position, if I understand her correctly, on which the argument in her article is based. For our panel, I would suggest to begin that there are four main questions raised by Arndt here. The first is, are truths given, or are they constructs of the human mind? The second question is, are there categories of truth, such as Arndt suggests, as rational truth and factual truth? The third question is factual truth really, as she suggests, the domain of politics? And finally, is there a common understanding, which she intimates, of factual truth that we can all depend on and agree on? Let me begin with you, Don, and then Adam and Mike. Please join in on these four questions, but I would like to ask you in any order except that I'd like to ask you if you would address the first question that Arndt assumes here. Are truths given, or are they constructs of the human mind?
Well, from a political standpoint, they're obviously constructs of a political mind. One suggestion or one analogy taken from philosophy is that in politics, there are only two things. That is, that person who perceives and the object that is perceived. If you don't perceive a particular object, it doesn't exist in politics, not until it intrudes upon your view and then suddenly you perceive it. So in politics, it's perception, which is one of the things that political analysts and political advocates really focus in on. So in terms of whether or not it is from a political standpoint, truth is something that we accept as a political body, I think that's the case. But then we have various interests in terms of who decides to shape the truth. So, for example, we have a great battle here in the United States over climate change. And you're talking about the ability to have power. There's an administration now that doubts that climate change exists. Lots of efforts to downplay that particular word. We know there's an industry that supports the idea that climate change is something that's in doubt, which is different than, say, for instance, many other conservative political parties across the globe, which accepts the concept of climate change. So we see in this particular instance that there is a political power, as you refer to and Arndt refers to, that is now crowding out this truth of climate change. It's just one example. So I think that when you look at politics, there will be truths that will begin to emerge into the psyche that are not invited, such as climate change, such as, for instance, the rising sea levels. What will it do with, say, for instance, New York or Miami? On the other hand, there are others where you can say, no, I'm going to keep that at bay. I'm thinking, for instance, the issue of creationism. Creationism obviously does not play a role in scientific investigation, but it does play a role in the body politic. Mm. And so, therefore, you get this clash. And where does creationism come from? It comes from an organized group of evangelical groups. That's who is another power center and has influenced what we teach in school, or what we, for instance, decide we're going to have creationism and evolution as an example, for instance. Even though in science, the practical side of things, creationism has no place at all. So this sort of gives you sort of an idea, at least, of, I think, the clashes that exist between truth on the one hand and the power circles and the power that exists on the other in a society, particularly political power, that then push truth out into whatever shape that they want to make it.
I mean, I would kind of add on to that, I think one of the things that's being sort of distinguished here is the difference between truth and facts, right? That we've got facts that are, you know, water falls from the sky, and, you know, we recognize that as a fact, but what is the truth of where it came from? We think early societies imagine that there must be a God who's doing this. And so, you know, we have this sort of movement from certain facts that can be verified, moving into truth, particularly as it applies to politics. If we think about the issue at the southern border, right? There's indisputable facts that there are a large number of people at the southern border, right? And we think about the term crisis is used on both left and right in terms of how we make a truth out of that fact, right? For conservatives, it is a crisis at the border of illegal immigration, right? And so that they take those facts, the sheer number of people, and make it into a crisis of immigration, where certain politics on the left say, no, it's a humanitarian crisis, right? And so we have the same basic facts in terms of number of people, but the truth that is constructed out of those facts is, I think, always feeding into a particular political perspective.
As a matter of fact, just break in here, the thing that struck me particularly about the immigration issue is we have, of course, on the one hand, the president talks about them being criminals and rapists and right. So on and so forth. We see the images, obviously, of children and so on. And one of the questions I have, and the way words shape the way we think of this issue, is should we be referring to these people coming to our border as immigrants, or should we refer to them as refugees? Right. Those two terms are much dramatically different. And if you talk, for instance, and I did, some of folks from Guatemala who came up, and it's clearly that they're refugees from violence and right. So on and so forth. So if you use that term, that shaves a much different light right. on seeking asylum than say, for instance, just immigrants.
What I would want to suggest before we move into the weeds here further is I think that truth is related to the whole concept of reality, that I think the material world is out there, whether we like it or not, whether we're here or not. If an asteroid comes tomorrow, human beings are gone, the universe will go on.
It's not a linguistic concept.
It's not a linguistic concept, yes. And so I think the term fact, then, is a human construct where we then try to label what we are trying to, what we see in the world itself. So climate change, we have a climate, those are words, it's language, it's a construct that we use to describe the realities of the world that we are experiencing. However flawed that is, it took us some time to recognize that climate change, in fact, was occurring. Yes, I mean, you had plenty of folks, scientists earlier, 20 years ago, said, oh, no, it's just the changes in how the Earth has evolved. And now they said, no, we got it. Why? Because we now have an ability. And here's why I'm much more optimistic than Arendt is, I think, that we have an ability now to understand our world in a way that we never had previously. So, now, whether you want to say, finally understand truth with a big T, I think is sort of a fool's errand, actually. I think we should be content with how much we can, in fact, discover and understand with our language and our claims.
It's interesting that Arndt suggests in this article that she sees, or for the sake of this article, she breaks truth into two. Into two divisions. One is rational truth, which is like Einstein's theory of relativity. Now, that's a rational truth. She would say, and she suggests that those are generally individual truths, truths created by individuals, axioms, and whether they last or what is another matter. But she suggests that it takes, I'm reading in here, that she suggests that factual truth is communal, that factual truth takes a community, I'm interpreting here, to adapt that truth that factual truth. Let me offer, and then you can respond to this and from the political perspective, but let me offer a definitional suggestion here. People might argue about what causes climate change, but there are very few people now, aren't I correct, that would say the world is not getting warmer. That's a fact.
Well, I think those that deny it, they might admit that it is getting warmer now, but just say, well, it'll ebb back eventually. That's just, the cycle of the planet, and, they sort of want to discredit, as Mike was sort of saying, that there are facts that have been discovered in science that 99.9% of all scientists agree on. And so, there's that sort of question of excluding facts from truth. I mean, is truth always going to be created by the inclusion of certain facts and the omission of other facts, right? Is that where we get sort of dogmatic truths, is always through a process of subtraction of some sort?
Well, she says there's a common understanding of truth. Right. I think she's assuming an awful lot here, but is she correct here? And then, Michael, I know you want to say something about the climate change as well.
It seems to me that, again, whether or not human beings recognize realities, the realities are there. So whether a community, to use her terms, I mean, she seems to want to say that it's only when you have a community that you can have facts. And it strikes me as that's untrue. I don't understand why that. I mean, it takes a community. It has taken the human institution of science and the organizations that we now recognize as a scientific community to have the ability and the tools and technology and the background development of theories to make these additional discoveries and then say, yeah, as we as a community now recognize that climate change is real. And these are the causes. And one of them is human beings, increasingly it's human beings. And that other kinds of arguments really don't hold water now, right? So the idea that somehow it's part of the evolution of the Earth, or that some God is angry at us, these are untrue. And here's our evidence, and here's our reason, right? So in this respect, again, I find Arendt confusing, frankly. I think she leads us into a dead end that we don't need to go there. We have the capabilities now to understand a lot more than we ever did previously, but it is a requirement that we need to. If we got rid of our scientific community, then we would, our candle in the dark would be blown out.
Would you be more comfortable with the concept of beliefs rather than truth? I mean, it seems to me, for instance, if you ask somebody, for instance, do you believe in climate change, right? Which is a belief, right? They say, I believe in it, as opposed to it being a truth as defined by a community.
I think belief is a claim of truth, most likely. When we say we believe something, we are saying we think this is true and this is not true.
That's the nature of assigning. It's a word of assigning.
Right.
That word to this concept. So you can assign it to the concept of belief. But the important thing here to me is that a community embraces this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one other thing to spin off the concept of belief is, so people say, do you believe in climate change? Or do you believe that human beings cause climate change, right? Because that's what's really at issue. Most people are not scientists. They haven't looked at this thing, and they're not expertise. So the only thing that can go on is what they believe and what they don't believe. And what has happened, particularly in the debate here in the United States, is that those people who do not want the things that would be required to deal with climate change, i.e., for instance, phasing out fossil fuels, will then say there is a doubt that this is actually true. Okay? And it's a doubt, but then it inserts itself into the beliefs that creates the belief that, well, maybe it's not really true. as opposed to, and therefore keeps us from acting, even though this reality beyond what we believe, that is from outside of our internal beliefs, that reality is still going on.
Yes.
And eventually it will intrude into our beliefs, yeah. No matter how much you want to say, no, it doesn't exist.
Well, right? This is where the I think the discussion has to go, why do you believe what you believe, right? You have to go to the reasons. Right? Do you have reasons or did you just hear about it? I mean, and here's clearly what, getting back into politics, what Trump has been doing is he's a very clever propagandist, and he's able to push away that discussion. You don't even want to talk about reasons for belief. You just want to have these beliefs and feelings. I mean, it is very much of a fascist notion. Feeling.
I think you're right. Trump has perhaps mastered it. I think you're right. But, I think we saw this, much before. Was Gingrich's moral majority sort of grounded on this as well? And it's not surprising that he's the guy who, and I can't remember the issue, but was called out about, well, that's not true. And he said, yeah, but people feel like it's true. Mm-hmm. And that we sort of recognize that, have we moved into, in the sort of contemporary realm, almost a quasi-religious adherence to politics, where it no longer requires verifiable facts of something. It's just, well, I believe that there's a God up in the sky, and that's just a fact, and I just believe that, where it doesn't require any scientific fact, any sort of verification, where it is just grounded purely on belief. Well, and has, has the contemporary technical age sort of allowed that? I know one of the questions later on here, and I don't mean to jump ahead, but the idea of, how do opinions play into the notion of truth? Well, if enough people believe it, then it's true, right? And we recognize with sort of the tribalism that we've talked about before, the sort of fragmenting of these communities, that as long as you have a group of people who think like you do, you can hold that as a truth.
Except, right?
Which is phenomenally dangerous, I think.
Let me come back to a point in one of our, in actually our first the first discussion we had on the nature of truth. And that is, as Michael mentioned earlier, there's a world out there, and we experience that world. And generally, we like to think of truth and even perhaps facts as something that comports with that world out there. It agrees with what's happening, and the example being, I talked to a young geographer down in Norfolk who is an expert on climate control. His comment was, as a scientist, I don't try to convince people of why and get into the political argument. But from his perspective, the fact is the water around Norfolk is rising and Norfolk is sinking. And because of the change in the climate, we have a problem to deal with. And would you agree that that might be the definition of a fact, of a fact that is true?
Most certainly. I mean, and I think the segue from fact into politics, or factual truths into politics, is what is the significance of what is happening and what will happen to us as a community? Because the political realm is the realm of action, is the realm that we human beings take action to better our society, to better our community. So the significance, if climate change was only happening in Antarctica, bad for the penguins maybe, but the rest of us, maybe refuge for the penguins, but that's unfortunately it's not the reality. The reality is it is affecting our communities around the world globally. And so the significance is, as the scientist is pointing out, now it's in your hands, politicians, now it's in the political realm. This is significant because you can't live submerged underwater, and the politics must engage.
But is there a reversal at times in politics, right? If we think that science proceeds from discovering certain facts and then creates its truths out of an accumulation of those facts, is politics often working the other way around, where I believe blank and therefore I'm going to go put it into action to make it real, right? Does it almost invert the process in some ways?
But it can't make it, I mean, you can't reverse, can't push the water down.
Right.
Right? So, right. But you can create, you can go, so you can propagandize, you can ignore it and just pray while the water is rising.
Right.
Right. And you can, and you can get, and you know, the whole notion, who you, they drank the Kool-Aid, right? The whole notion, right, is, and they all died.
Right.
And that's what we face. So I don't think, so in that sense, I think you can convince yourself in error, but you can't change the reality.
Well, right. I think, but it goes to a slightly different question, particularly about climate change, is the issue is not whether or not the sea level is rising. You can see lots of communities, even people who don't know whether or not human beings have created, well, we got to take steps in order to protect ourselves. Mitigation, right? Mm-hmm. But the fundamental issue that human beings are creating the crisis may be very well denied by that person who is carrying out the mitigation process of keeping the seas at bay. In short, the real truth is not so much that the sea is rising, which is evident in itself. Why is it rising? And it seems to me that the ability of people to ignore the reality of human beings causing this, that's the truth that you're really stumbling over, rather than recognizing that, yes, the seas are rising, we got to do something about it in terms of our own little piece of land, right? But yes, the greater cause as to why it's happening, the other fact, can be easily ignored, and often we hear that be the case, right?
I mean, I agree, but it's the question then becomes, how is it that some people can continue to ignore or have beliefs that are based on false assumptions?
And I would suggest to you that it's
a conundrum right there.
Yeah.
I would suggest, and the thing you read first, it's power. Okay, why is it that many people believe that climate change doesn't exist? There is a whole set of industries and have particular interest in denying that it is occurring, and one of the techniques is to create doubt. And what's fascinating is that many of the same people who created doubt about cigarette smoking are now involved with climate change doubt,
yeah,
if nothing else.
But here's where I think Arendt is again at a dead end. I'm sorry to get you, but because on the one hand you're absolutely right. It's the fossil fuel industry. And the Trump administration, Republicans generally right now, they're a party of climate change deniers. And that is, and make her point, power is moving against truth, right? On the other hand, there is power elsewhere as well. Science is a power, an increasingly important power, thankfully. There is a Democratic Party. It's not power versus truth. It's various bastions of power, spheres of power, if you wish, competing in the face of truth.
Shaping what people believe is true.
Yes, okay? I agree with that. I agree with that. You can't right. Shape truth.
But I think even in terms of science, right, that there are those who say, well, but the eggheads in the university science, you know, the science people, they're just a bunch of coastal elites, they're a bunch of radical leftists, so of course they're pushing a certain version of science, right? And that has taken hold in a good segment of the population who, instead of seeing scientific results and saying, that's offering us some sort of truth, they see it and say, that is just purely ideology, right? And so, I mean, the classic question of the role of ideology in truth begins to complicate it as well. Because, again, for, you know, you and I who work in a university, if a scientist says it, our tendency is to say, well, if you've done the research on it, I will believe you on that. But that's a particular perspective, right? That there's plenty of, more conservative America that might be encountered with those scientific facts and say, yeah, but it's coming out of those elite leftist institutions, therefore I refuse to believe it.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, again, that we have, very often truth, and I mentioned this earlier, and I don't want to sort of beat a dead horse, but that very often truth is the removal of fact to arrive at it, right? Because it's not as if a lot of people are reading the climate science and engaging with it intellectually on a scientific level of, well, I question the statistical pattern you used or the research analysis. Yeah. It's just that, no, that's coming out of radical leftist institutions, therefore I don't believe it at all.
Would you agree, though, that still they are in error? They may believe that. We can believe erroneous things.
Right.
To our dying days. You know, so, I mean, what? Right. Yeah.
But on the other hand, that may be the case. On the other hand, we can continue to deny, for instance, that climate change, that we are causing climate change, and that belief will then ultimately have an impact on what happens down the road. So beliefs can have an impact on the reality, right? I mean, we saw, you know, I've been reading something about the First World War, and one of the fascinating things is nobody believed that would happen. And then suddenly there it was, and all these people were dead, right? And each step of the way, they couldn't see the end product. And I think that's the same thing with a lot of things. And I mean, you think about, for instance, the anti-vaxxers, right? The people who oppose vaccinations. And the question then becomes, so where did they get this belief that vaccinations are bad? Well, they get it from a new medium, generally speaking, of social media, of this really fluid communication system that we now have, so that you can get people out there who make certain claims about vaccinations, and people read and they say, that must be true. Same thing, for instance, with the great birther movement surrounding President Obama. Same kind of thing, where people would pass this stuff around. And even when he, say, offered up the birth certificate, the real one, the one that everybody really wanted, there were all these people on social media said, there's some problems here, even though there weren't any, right? Which then had an impact on what people believe, what's real as opposed to what's true.
Is this a sense then of the kind of worldview? You had mentioned it earlier, Michael, that people bring their own worldview, their own attitude about the world to the situation. Is that, to a degree, Don, what we're talking about in terms of vaccination? Is this, I hate to use a cliche, but I've been known to before, is this kind of the sense that you're an anti, either have the attitude that you're an anti-science person, you're an anti-verification, or that's your view. So you depend simply on the opinions that you hear with no evidence. Or, on the other hand, you've got to show me.
Well, you've got to prove it to me. I do think, and we've talked about this before, that particularly for the United States, I think there was a great disillusionment with establishment opinions coming particularly out of the 1960s, right? Mm-hmm. Particularly, obviously, you had the war that was going on. But there was also beginning to look at the environmental impacts of industries. And then there was beginning to question of science itself. Some of the recommendations, for instance, that were made, and people said, well, I don't know, maybe that's not, maybe we don't really want to do that, i.e., when we move into the issue of vaccinations and whether you think they're good or not good, right? So there is also an underlying sense, particularly in the last 50 years or so, in American society, of a suspicion of science and whether or not whether the conclusions are right or not right, whether the studies with rats are really accurate or not accurate, can you really get cancer from this or not get cancer from that? So there's a real sort of undertone besides the ideological right-left. There's also a disillusion which sort of seems to have come out of the air with not only with government but with science itself, and that produces this kind of I don't really believe this thing that you've studied for so long. I mean, and whether it's elites or whether it's just you don't believe anymore that what somebody is telling you is true or not. And this emerges really in some ways out of the fact that we now move, particularly in this modern age, away from what the gatekeepers, in which there were people who like vetted this information and then you sat around your TV or you read it in your newspaper and say, oh, okay. Somebody actually looked at it before it got to you. Now you're just sort of getting the raw information and say, you figure it out, right? So you've got that combined with social media, which even speeds up even further. So I think in that sense, you've got a situation where there's an underlying skepticism or cynicism about what somebody's telling you.
I would use the term ideology with regard to belief systems. And I think one way to understand it essentially is that the right-left spectrum, part of it, I mean, it's complex to be sure, but part of one dimension of it is on the right or center ideologies tend to be more open to religious-based thinking, whereas left of center ideologies now are tend to embrace science-based or empirically based understandings of the world. And I think what's happening, in effect, is that it used to be argued that, well, somehow, you know, religion and science can live together comfortably. And I think what is happening instead is that science is increasingly challenging religious assumptions and marginalizing religion, right? Because the climate change deniers, or I always use the abortion case as an example of this, the pro-life folks, they embrace non-scientific thinking, religious, spiritual thinking, right? Which is, I mean, ultimately you can't push it anywhere because there's no basis upon which you can say whether one thing is true or not. It's simply a belief in the spirit world, right? Whereas science has essentially challenged that, constantly pushing that aside. And I think that that's given rise to part of our situation today. Because climate change deniers, what do they say? I mean, they say God wouldn't allow this to happen. I mean, you get that kind of response. And what do you say to that? Offering scientific evidence is only meaningless for that kind of argument.
I think you're right. Do you think that it's gotten worse given being in the midst of, you know, a lot of people have referred to as another culture war, right? They're saying not since the 60s and 70s have we seen a culture war sort of like this. And so I'm wondering if that division between, you know, and I think you're right, generally the right adhering more to religious notions, generally the left adhering more to scientific notions. The further you get out in the fringes, it starts to get strange, but in a general sort of sense. But has the sort of culture war increased that sedimentation of positions, right? Because we, you know, it's one thing to talk about climate change, right, as sort of a singular issue, but when we look at the culture wars sort of generally, that if you think about, again, people who might be on the right being more religious, right, where they're looking at climate issues, but they're also looking at transgender issues, right, which just floors many of them, gay rights, any number of these sort of things. And so I'm wondering if that has had the function of just sedimenting those positions irrevocably far apart now, which is why, you know, I think you sort of see that most of the talking heads that we start to see seem to be more extreme right or more extreme left, right? That the sort of moderate center on both sides doesn't get the airplay as sort of the more extreme sedimented positions.
I agree. I think that, I mean, I think the culture wars, as you really identified, I think, that make that kind of distinction is an empirically based understanding about scientific understanding about sexuality, scientific understanding about climate change. Whereas on the right, there is this steadfast set of beliefs anchoring in some kind of, in our case, a Christian belief systems that challenge. This is not man and a woman. That's what the Bible says. Right. And they go to those texts, right? In this case, the Bible, Christian Bible, whichever variation of the Bible, but nonetheless, and for their truth base, I guess, again, based within a belief in some kind of God.
Although it seems to me that religion may be one manifestation, but I think there's something. But I think there's a whole set of cultural issues that have been exacerbated by the fact that this nation itself is changing, not only in terms of its ethics, in terms of what it seems is moral. For instance, I'm obviously mentioned that, for instance, the gay marriage equality, for example, that sort of thing. The idea that, for instance, you're now beginning to see people talk about some kind of control over guns, gun legislation, which is becoming far more popular than it was. You see the change, the demographic change in terms of minorities, the fact that whites who have dominated, right, the society for many years with very similar cultural mores now see something different than what they are. That the culture war that we're seeing it will probably last for some time because the nation itself is dramatically changing. Just as, for instance, when I look back in the 1960s, it was a cultural explosion then in which the recognition of that all these minorities and all these groups who had been suppressed at one point, now they all came to the surface. And what did a lot of folks who were in the white majority do? They reacted badly to it, whether it's trying to keep African-Americans, for instance, out of their neighborhoods. That was a classic example. So I think this change, it may get worse, it may extend over a long period of time, but the fact of the matter is that this society is beginning to recognize that there is not just simply two halves, but there's a diminishing half. And as the smaller you get as away from the from being a majority, the more and more you feel embattled, I think.
Yes, yes. Right. What's fascinating for me, getting back to truth versus power, presently, power residing in a Trump presidency and a Republican Party are denying truths. They're denying that more guns means more death. They're denying the rights of minority folks and transgender folks. They're denying climate change. But the majority of the public, right, I mean, this is where there is at least some cause for hope. The majority of public, you know, they're for more gun regulation. They're for transgender rights. They're for, they recognize climate change and they want something done about it. So the possibility for power then to actually be in harmony with truth is possible.
Except that, yeah. So to talk about the politics of this. Yeah. So what is the politics of this? It is to hold on to that power. So what do they do? So we have, for instance, voter ID, or we don't allow felons to vote, or we're going to do gerrymandering, for example, or the idea that we should only count citizens and legal residents as opposed to for representation. There's this big push now in order to contain the tide that you talk about that is coming. How long they can hold it back, I think, is a big question, because eventually the dam will break. Or you think, for instance, about the court system and the Supreme Court, judicial, right? One of the important elements in the good service strategy is to get as many people in the courts as possible who think like them, so they can will be able to hold back the tide for much longer than just simply an election or two. So this struggle, I think, politically is happening.
But I mean, if the left was in power, they'd be doing the same sort of thing. I mean, that's just how politics functions, is, you know, the maintenance of self.
What I would suggest is, but I think the problem is that the left is not a diminishing. It's not a diminishing movement. I mean, I sat down and I read AOC's New Green Deal, right? And I said, well, gee, this all makes kind of sense, you know. Like, for instance, the most controversial was, like, you know, guarantee everybody a new job. Well, did anybody remember the Humphrey Hawkins full employment bill? Okay. I mean, isn't that something we want to, like, aspire to, right? So all of these ideas that she's kind of spun in, and things like Medicare for all, well, we may not get Medicare for all, but we will probably get a medical system that will provide health care to everybody. That's not a conservative or a right-wing or a culturally conservative idea. The future belongs to those progressives, not the current conservatives. Even though I'm sure that I know there are people who take a different view of that, but I think that's the future. Just as to steal a phrase here. So, in the late 1800s, who were the leftists of the time? It were people like Jefferson, who thought, oh, you could actually have a group of people who can actually have self-government, because all of everybody else was under divine right. If you were a conservative in that time, you were a Tory. You were a monarchist. So you see this change that keeps on moving.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing I would say about AOC, for example, and she's a prime sort of political example, is that even if, and I'm not sure I totally agree with this, but even if we go with the notion that the future is going to go to the progressives, the question of how fast is that shift going to happen, right? Where we have somebody like Pelosi, right, sort of more of an old school politician who seems to be playing the long game, right? Have we moved away from that possibility in politics, right? Politics was often sort of seen as a long game of, you know, well, we're setting up things for years in advance, where the newer, more extreme politicians, and I think this is true on both sides, have the sort of, but no, we want this all right now, right? And that there is an immediacy to it that the other side, of course, is going to push back on, right? Where it doesn't seem to have the dialectical process of movement as much as
But isn't it part of the dialectical process? Well, that, did you have these energy things that they clash with one another and they kind of shift, right?
Yes, but AOC, I mean, unlike Pelosi, AOC is simply refuses to play ball in some ways.
But isn't that part of the political process, right? I mean, if you don't stand your ground, then you don't get movement, right? That's the theory, right? So you keep pulling this forward, whether it's, but I mean, think about for the civil rights movement, for example, was demonstrations and so on and so forth. Martin Luther King said, "No, we're not going to."
Justice delayed is justice denied.
That's right. So he pushed.
He pushed, absolutely. See, that's why I want to challenge you just a bit here. That I don't see Ocasio-Cortez as extreme. Mm. I think she's recognizing. She's saying, "Look, guys, you know, the climate isn't waiting for us. We've got a window." Right. And that's what the science. They're saying you got a window to do something. You don't do something within that window, that means a certain time frame. Ball game is over. Go home, right? You just got to deal with the water that's rising. I think similarly, you know, when Warren says at the debate where the question was asked, how many of you support a health care plan that would get rid of private companies?
How many of you get
and
it
she
up,
went, yeah. Boom, yeah. Right? And basically she's saying, look, guys, it's not going to work. If you want to get health care for all, decent health care for all, private companies, corporations are not interested in that. That system's not going to work. You need a government-run program. I mean, and I think it's unfair to call that extreme, if indeed it's actually a truth. A truth is not extreme by definition. It's simply recognizing a certain reality. And what we have is in the healthcare system, the market system has failed. We have market failure in terms of providing decent health care for everybody in the society.
But Michael, what is the fact here then?
The fact,
Michael,
the fact,
because what I'm hearing in hearing in the discussion is that we're beyond art now. We're talking about no, but she was responding to the response of her reporting at the Eichmann trial.
Right.
And
which has its own complications in and of itself.
Which she argued was filled with lies on all the sides.
Right.
And that's why she got into this lying thing. But she's talking about truth as facts that we accept. Hmm. And we've done that. The water is rising. That's the fact that most people, I think, except, so are we now beyond the realm of factual truth, and we're talking about methodology in terms of political methodology and how to engage that truth? So now we've got with AOC in one side wanting to press in one direction, we've got Nancy Pelosi wanting to press another direction. And then we've got another power center in the president, a big power center, who's saying none of it really matters. And almost a denial that the water is even rising.
I think to Mike's point, even if we say, right, if we all sort of collectively agree climate change is real and all these things are happening, if the Democratic Party's main goal is to win the White House in 2 years, right, is the Green New Deal going to be one of those things where that 5% in the middle that shifts back and forth, that they're going to go, yep, that's totally what I want? Probably not, right? And so I think that was sort of my sense.
I wonder whether that's true. You see, because I think the political landscape is continually shifting. And like, for instance, when we look at, for instance, the Democratic Party, we're looking at a Democratic Party that's probably emerging now from what was the Democratic Leadership Council,
right,
and the Clinton era, which tended to shift slightly to the right in order to win the election,
right?
And then, right, because that's where the country was. And if you think about, for instance, when Ronald Reagan was elected, it was 85% was white as electorate. Well, that's now all shifting. So I think so that when I look out and I see Bernie Sanders up there, Bernie Sanders is kind of like old hat. And all these other people who are talking about progressive ideas or the ideas that he talked about, they are his political children. He doesn't even need to be there anymore. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the year 2016, he was the only game that was opposed or right. In contrast to the Clintonian Democratic Leadership Council approach to politics. With somebody like Pelosi, Pelosi has to manage this. It's not that she is not sympathetic towards AOC or the solutions, but she's trying to figure out how to get from here to there, to keep her majority, to move in that direction. I don't think she's unsympathetic with AOC, even though they have, obviously, the differences.
Well, you know, and again, and I think in some ways that's sort of the point I was trying to make, yeah. is that even if Pelosi agreed with everything AOC says,
right.
I don't think that's the case, but even if she did, she also knows that Pelosi is a very divisive figure. I'm sorry, that AOC is a very divisive right. figure. And so that she is, in essence, sort of softening the play in some ways in order to try to get, I think, more of those swing voters. Where, you know, AOC, there is no one, I don't think anyone who voted for Trump in the last election is going to hear AOC and go, you know what, I'm going to vote for the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that is not the margin that the Democrats need to focus on in terms of shifting those politics.
This is what I'm hearing is this kind of the family argument mm-hmm. in here, that the goal, the principle, the fact is kind of accepted by the family. How to get there, how to engage it, how to do our differences of our arguments mm-hmm. among the family, in a sense. But Arndt says that facts and events are incredibly fragile things that power can manipulate and can, in fact, make facts disappear and make events in memory, in a sense. Disappear. We have the other side of this whole issue is, as I mentioned a minute ago, the other power center. Where is the other power center relative to these facts, and what is the power center? And Don alluded to it, I think, a few minutes ago. What is this power center, the president's power center, doing to make these facts that are unacceptable facts, inconvenient facts, I think is the word, to make these inconvenient facts go away, and so I ask you, where is the attack coming on these facts? And I think, Don, you mentioned earlier the whole voter,
sure.
the whole changes in voting across the country. So talk about how this power center is attacking or affecting what we might consider the facts, mm-hmm. the true facts out
there. Well, as a matter of fact, I ran across a great thing called organized lying. Basically, and it seems to me that this kind of works, right? Although it could be 1984, right? So one is rewriting history, right? You rewrite the history of whatever it is. You reject science, right? You delete data that doesn't agree with you. We've seen that too. And then you spin doubt and cynicism, right? Now, it seems to me that these techniques are what are being employed in social media. And I'm not just talking about the president. I'm talking about, like, lots of people, right. not just, you know, and employed particularly in a milieu of social media in which, because there are no gatekeepers, you get the raw information, people can spin things any way they want, or they reject science, or they rewrite history, or what it was that actually happened. So I think in terms of, like, techniques, in terms of getting at what is truth and what isn't truth, that, I think, is the way that people do it. And if I think about, for instance, the extreme examples, for instance, if you think about, for instance, Nazi Germany, for example, right? They did all of these things, right? You know, and they did. Now, there was fairly closed society in many ways, as opposed to ours, which is this wide open thing, right, which is difficult to control. But nonetheless, they did it in a way, and you wind up with, for instance, when they went after the Jewish population in Germany, well, they basically dipped into sentiment that was already there and just took it to this this awful place, right? So you can see that people in power will manipulate in ways to rewrite history, to delete information or to keep you from information. The other thing that's interesting is you don't need absolute censorship either. You can merely flood the world with whatever it is that you've got, and in social media it can spread like fire. Mm-hmm. And the Russians, of course, obviously discovered this in 2016, right? So, I mean, so those are the kinds of techniques. Yeah,
I recommend to our listeners Noam Chomsky, Manufacturing Consent. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been...
Manufacturing
Consent. And there's an industry. It's a PR industry, and it's built in the corporate world. And governments and states, of course, glommed onto these, to the methodologies and the strategies for how to shape belief systems, how to shape what the public thinks, how to shape what the public thinks about removing inconvenient truths and facts, the memory, down the memory hole, right? Orwell's terminology, right? And so I think with response to your question, the centers, I would argue that the centers are both in the state itself, because Trump is just perhaps Exhibit A, right, or Exhibit Z, maybe more accurately, in terms of a history of officials within states manipulating reality, manipulating what people know and how they're going to know it, but also within the corporate world itself. I mean, we all know the history of cigarette smoking. We all know the history that corporations knew early back in the 50s that cigarette smoking causes cancer. What did they do? They didn't say, we're going to cease making cigarettes. They hid that information. Marlboro Man's out there. They persuaded people to smoke. And in spite of the fossil fuel industry, as happy as clams at high tides, to deregulate their industry at this present point in time and to try to convince us that they have cleaner coal now. Well, it's a wonderful term, right? Clean coal.
Can I just add one more book recommendation?
Orwell's
1984. I mean, I think it's the classic model of how this is done so effectively.
Yes. We're out of time, and I want to thank the three of you very, very much for an excellent, excellent discussion. Let me end with a note of optimism. Again, from art that I think is, and you alluded to, frankly, Mike, even though you said you didn't care much for the paper. But let me end with this. She says that facts are not secure in the hands of power. Is obvious. But the point here is that power, by its very nature, can never produce a substitute for the secure stability of factual reality, which, because it is past, has grown into a dimension beyond our reach. Facts assent themselves by being stubborn, and their fragility is oddly combined with a great resiliency, the same irreversibility that is the hallmark of all human action. Facts are stubborn things and tend not to go away. Thank you very, very much for participating today, and thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today Writers Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.